afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us for session six of the National Resources Tax Conference. I'm Alistair Smith from EY, and I have the pleasure today of introducing our next topic and panelists. For the next hour, the panel will be discussing the new interest limitation rules. The session will commence with an overview of the debt deduction creation rules, before moving on to a discussion of the new thin cap provisions, closing out with 10 minutes of Q&A. During the session, feel free to use the attendee hub to submit any questions you would like posed. Alternatively, we'll walk the floor at the end of the session for questions as well. Before we get started, if I can remind everyone to please turn their phones onto silent. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce and hand over to our panellists for today. We've got Cameron Blackwood, Partner and Head of Tax at Corrs Chambers Westgarth, Matthew Chamberlain, International Tax Partner at EY, and Harjit Singh, Assistant Commissioner in the Tax Council Network from the ATO. Thank you.
Generally, I don't need one of these things, so if I'm too loud, please let me know. So good afternoon, everyone. Matthew Chamberlain from EY. Lots of familiar faces in the room, which is great to see. Welcome, everyone, from both Perth and elsewhere. It's fantastic that we're able to run such a brilliant energy-focused session and couple of days for you. So what I'd like to do, though, if you can just indulge me for a moment, is I just want to acknowledge Wayne Healy and his recent tragic passing. I don't know if any of you who grew up in the Western Australian Tax Institute or had anything to do with Wayne at a national level. He was an extraordinary individual and an incredibly committed member of the Tax Institute and gave 1,000 times more than he ever received from the TTI. So I'd just like to personally acknowledge his recent passing and commiserations to his family and friends. So, all right, so we're going to spend the next 60 minutes or thereabouts together, about 50 minutes. We're hopefully going to leave kind of 10 minutes at the end. As Al has indicated, we're going to walk through the various different elements in interest limitation rules. And then basically I'll do some brief introductions. To the extent that Harjit's then able to share some ATO views, we'll push those to Harjit, and then Cameron will lead you through some of the examples out of the PCG and just some issues and topics of interest. We're not going to stick slavishly to the slides. There's no point. Given the quality of the audience, we're also not just going to sit there and repeat verbatim the EM and various things. So hopefully what we'll do is we'll give you some insights, some questions, some queries, you know, have a bit of back and forwards between the three of us, and then ideally leave you with some kernels and some queries and some challenges to come to at the end. So, you know, clearly this is new, clearly it's hot, clearly there was a lot of stuff that was rushed, a lot of stuff that wasn't, with all due respect to Harjit, I don't think it was necessarily the ATO's making, a lot of stuff that wasn't discussed or agreed or consulted. Debt deduction creation rules, I'm looking at you, 2590, etc. So really we're just in a position where a lot of this is a bit of a moving feast and we're just trying to sort out some of the practicalities. So, okay. Thanks. Thank you.
Excellent.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Cameron. Good job.
Thank you. So the first part will just be focused on the debt deduction creation rules and probably dealing primarily with the PCG that was released by the ATO in terms of providing some guidance as to how the rules would work, but in particular trying to provide some guardrails as to restructuring to deal with those rules. So we'll focus on that first. Before we get into that, it is probably worth just doing a brief overview, if that is possible, of these rules in terms of the ordering, who's in and who's out, who's caught, and the particular anti-avoidance rule and why it's causing some issues. So just a brief recap as to who these rules apply to. So it captures general class investors and non-banks. The outward exclusion, we have 90% plus Aussie assets, does not apply in this case, so you can be exempt from thin cap, but still subject to DDCR, and then there are exemptions for the banks and the like. In terms of the ordering, so you're meant to apply the DDCR first to figure out what's been knocked out, and then apply thin cap to whatever's left. With one caveat though, if you are lucky enough to be able to apply the third party debt test, and as long as it's not a contrived choice, which we'll come to, whatever that means, then the DDCR won't generally apply. So. Which is an important consideration. But big picture, what these rules are trying to capture, and I'll use the concept of related party just because associate pair is a bit of a mouthful. But effectively, these rules kick in whenever you use related party debt to do a particular related party thing, being an acquisition or a certain type of payment. Critically, these rules has no purpose requirement and are self-executing, which we'll flesh out in a bit. As well. In terms of the two particular types, so there's the type one, which is where you have a related party borrowing to acquire or to hold an asset or a legal or equitable obligation, and you've acquired or are holding that asset or obligation from a related party. So some concepts there. Related party acquisition probably makes sense, and we know what that is. Acquisition of an obligation, bit of a question mark as to what that is. In terms of the sheer scope of these rules, it kicks in when you have direct or indirect acquisitions through interposed entities. So very broad in the potential application. There are some exceptions where you are subscribing for new membership interests, acquiring new tangible depreciating assets and mere on lending, but you always need to look through. So just because you equity fund an entity, if the entity you put funds into did a naughty thing, so to speak, then you're still caught. So that's the first type, when you're acquiring or holding an asset. The second type is where, again, you use a related party borrowing to fund or facilitate the funding of certain types of payments, dividends, distribution, royalties, and the like. But critically, as I said, self-executing, no purpose. Where there is a commissioner's discretion and purpose, though, is there is a specific anti-avoidance rule in the DDCR provisions, which we'll spend a bit of time on, and that kicks in when you have a principal purpose of doing something to get out of the DDCR. And the classic case is where you're doing a refinancing or the like, where you have bad debt. The final call out I'll make in terms of, and this comes through in a lot of the submissions, is the EM says that the DDCR anti-avoidance rule should only really be kicking in for contrived arrangements, and indeed the commission or one of the assistant commissioners before the Senate said something similar as well. But these are exceptionally broad rules, quite wide-ranging in their potential application, and critically, as we'll touch on in a moment, not grandfathered, no transition, and for many in this room, they're the type of issues that we're grappling with. So the PCG...
So just for you, can I ask a question? Practically, do you believe that all related party debt for a prescribed purpose is prima facie non-deductible?
Well, I think because you're put to proof, so it's a... You're almost starting from that proposition, I think. Yeah. So, as I said, related party debt, doing a related party thing, you've got an issue.
So that's your starting point, and you basically work backwards.
Work backwards.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
I might hand over just to make some comments about the PCG.
Yeah, sure. No, so thank you for having us here. Just wanted to provide a bit of context to the creation of the PCG. The ATO has been involved in consulting on public advice and guidance prior to the law being passed. And given the nature of how the law was passed, and Matthew, you touched upon that a little bit earlier, there probably wasn't that much engagement from stakeholder community on PAG or public advice and guidance priorities at the time. But since the law passed, there was strong engagement to see some sort of interpretive guidance around this very broad integrity provision containing the Think Act rules. And so what we were also confronted with was law that had passed partway through an income year to which it already applied around the Think Act. Yes, absolutely. Something that was introduced, yeah. Given that it already applied for the ThinCap rules, which we'll talk a little bit about later, from 1 July 2023, and then the debt creation rules coming up from incoming years commencing on 1 July 2024 onwards, we are very conscious and we heard feedback that we needed to provide timely public advice and guidance on when we would actually be applying these rules and also what restructures would be permitted and to which the specific purpose rule that Cameron, you touched on earlier, would apply. And so the PCG was selected as that vehicle, not because it's the perfect vehicle to provide certainty, certainly around interpretive advice, but it really was there to provide something that was timely and was practical. One of the things that we certainly heard in that initial consultation feedback was it wasn't just about when the ATO or the Commissioner would apply this particular rule to a transaction, but really it was about permissive guidance where taxpayers and the stakeholder community could understand when we wouldn't seek to apply compliance resources. So originally, if you have seen the structure of the PCG, there are two schedules to it that have been released. Schedule one wasn't something that we anticipated to include at the start. But based on that stakeholder feedback, we included these base case scenarios to say, when would the DDCR actually apply or not apply before we looked at restructuring out of that transaction? And I'm happy to provide some comments later because the consultation period has closed and we have started going through some of that feedback. And while I can't comment on what we're going to change in the PCG at this stage, I can certainly provide some of the common themes that we're seeing.
No, thanks for that. And I think it's probably worth starting probably with the historical aspect of these rules, because for those who've been through the PCG, it does, you know, spend a little bit of time discussing the approach, and there's statements in there about how the onus is on the taxpayer, probably an acknowledgement that the expectations on record keeping necessarily is different going forward compared to what would have been in the past. I guess one of the comments in there is that people had put to the ATO about, well, can we just have a 5-year look back rather than going back to the beginning of time, so people can try and come up with an approach there. I guess a question from me, in terms of how the ATO is thinking about going backwards where records aren't perfect, there was a change in the rules. How are you thinking about the compliance approach?
Yeah, look, I think ATO does have some sympathy for taxpayers in this circumstance. I think we've all stated on the floor so far that the rules are the rules in that they do require tracing to occur, right? Now, how that actually occurs and how we grapple with tracing and apportionment to the extent that tracing is not possible is one that we're certainly open to hearing from the taxpayer community. I'll be very transparent to say until the recent submissions that we got to the PCG, we got very little engagement to provide us with helpful examples that we could then demonstrate would be a realistic or practical way forward for taxpayers. And you know, the ATO, we regularly get criticised for not, you know, making real world examples, right? And so we really didn't want to put something out there that might not be practical. I'm pleased to say though that with the recent round of submissions, we're starting to see taxpayers engaging on that issue and providing us with potentially ways that we could consider how apportionment could happen in the real world. Not saying that we can accept everything, but we're certainly open to hearing. If you think you haven't yet provided anything on that in that regard, we'd be happy to hear from you.
So, Hajid, does that mean we're hopefully going to see more nuanced kind of examples in the final version of the PCG?
Around tracing and apportionment?
Just generally?
Look, another theme that's come out certainly has been more examples. Put out some examples that we thought were clearly in one side of the equation versus the other. Yep. What has become apparent is certainly when it comes to low risk examples, most of the feedback has been that further facts need to be included for it to be practical. And I think with Schedule 1, when the DDCR would or would not apply, I think we would seek to potentially have some additional examples. But like I said, that wasn't the focus of the PCG. The PCG was actually designed to focus on restructuring. And so to the extent we can provide assistance in Schedule 1, we will certainly try to do so. I think in Schedule 2, we might see some additional examples being included.
I think that's good, because one of the things, as you would expect with a PCG, is all about, you know, which colour zone you are in terms of are they going to get compliance resources. And I think having some examples where you think you're okay, but the facts aren't always there, I think under the current version, you are more often not going to end in the yellow zone, which basically says, watch this space, because you had, for anyone on the white zone who's been lucky enough to have a settlement agreement on these rules already, you know, well done. That's you. Green zone is when you're straight in. And then red zone, there are a couple, probably somewhat extreme examples, which we can touch on, which said you have had a problem there in particular.
That's probably a nice segue to go into some of the examples that you wanted to cover. Karen?
Yeah, exactly. So we're not going to go through all of them, but we will unpack at the end some of the key themes. But example two is an interesting one, I think, because it does call out a number of the issues with the rules more generally. So this is one where, and also dovetail nicely with the people in the room, but we've got a mining company has an existing asset which is in production, so spitting off cash, so he's able to pay up dividends up the chain. They've got a second company which has bought a new gold tenement, and it's in the development phase. And in this case, the way they decided to fund that is to have a third-party borrowing offshore and then to move that debt into Australia through a related party loan. So as I say, this example does call out a number of things. I guess the first one, for those who've been through the PCG, it doesn't really deal with the consolidation rules. So my obvious question might be, well, can't I put a circle around all those entities and kind of move on? But let's park that for a moment. The other thing it calls out with the DDCR when you're not able to apply the third-party debt test is there's no equivalent of a conduit financing regime. Because I guess another way of looking at this is there is a third-party borrowing. We've just chosen to do it offshore and then move it into Australia through a related party loan. I guess the obvious call out with these rules, and it's a debate for another time, is if we'd simply borrowed in Australia to begin with, then we wouldn't be having this discussion in the first place. But as I say, there is a bit going on here. And when you look at this example, you go, well, there isn't a related party acquisition, so why am I really concerned about the DDCR? And I think the concern is, and I'll give my two cents on what it's trying to deal with, is it's that second type of DDCR where I'm not borrowing to pay a dividend, but am I borrowing to facilitate the funding of a dividend? Because an alternative universe would have been that, well, rather than using the cash that's being spat out by my production asset, I would use that cash instead of paying a dividend, I would use it to fund the development. So by borrowing, could it be said that I am facilitating the payment of a dividend? The example goes on to say, well, in the ATO's view, you don't have an issue, but you only don't have an issue for the development phase. So it's probably one of those ones which would warrant some further facts, because what happens once development's finished? I could refi, I could start paying dividends. There's a number of things I could go on. So it is one of those examples which I think brings together a number of the issues with the rules, but does provide a level of comfort, I guess, as to facilitate the funding of. But that's my two cents, but interested in your perspective.
Yeah, sure. Look, I won't add too much more, Cameron, other than to say that example two falls into that schedule one, which is seeking to try to determine, when the DDCR applies. I agree with you that it's seeking to address, facilitate the funding of. What we were certainly looking to do here is to provide a permissive example that was put to us by industry around when scenario like this is confronted, and to be able to show where tracing can actually make a bit of sense. Now, when it comes to actually what would happen once this entity got out of development, I think that has been certainly a theme. Probably two comments on that. One is it's not meant to be an interpretive piece, and in an ideal world we'd create a ruling on the DDCR and then issue this PCG, and probably not out of the realm of possibility that next year we start looking at that. But we want to ensure that we are actually covering off in scenarios that make sense and are real world, but when it starts getting into various facts and circumstances, unless we can get some common ones across industry groups, we're going to struggle to really provide something here that that people find helpful.
The other example, just worth touching on as well, once my clicker works, is I guess the issue that has caused issues not just in this industry but across is the use of cash pooling arrangements, and the fact that despite a number of submissions to Treasury to say can we carve out cash pooling arrangements, they're a legitimate cash management tool, Treasury said no. So we're kind of stuck with it. And I guess what the example is calling out is, to make an obvious point, that just because you're using a cash pooling arrangement doesn't mean that you don't potentially have an issue. One thing which is implicit in this example is, the cash pool leader, so to speak, is a related party. And what the ATO says in this example is, well, you kind of need to track your balance. So if Australia is in positive, so effectively has a deposit, then you won't have an issue. But then when you flip into negative, then potentially you do have an issue depending on the use of funds. And I guess if you're having to track it on a day-by-day, from a day-by-day perspective, it makes it somewhat challenging potentially to administer it. So it is one of those ones, and we'll come to what the ATO says in terms of restructuring out of that. But it does mean that each pool is going to be different. You could have a notional pooling arrangement, for example, where each entity engages directly with the bank and the pooling's done on a notional basis. But I guess it is just an example as to the type of what we would all say are genuine commercial arrangements, but unfortunately the way the rules are drafted potentially picks you up.
Yeah, look, I won't add much more other than we've certainly heard the feedback around notional cash pooling. We appreciate where there's a high volume of transaction, this can be very complex. I think you're going to touch on it a little bit later, but there is an example contained later around the repayment of a cash pool balance and entering into some related party transactions, where we have tried to provide some guidance on what could be the future for an entity involved in cash pooling.
Yeah, and the example is basically to capitalise it or use clean funds or don't change charge interest. So does require some change, but I think if there's some guidance on notional pooling, I think would be welcomed.
I think we take the feedback that some of our low risk is no risk. I think that's come through loud and clear.
I think that's right. So there are a number of other examples in the PCG, and I guess there are a few that are worth calling out, or just the concepts or things to watch out for. But if we go back to the first example we went through, so one of the themes in the PCG is, well, when is it okay to refinance related party debt with third party debt? And I must say, when you start off, you go, surely this is going to be okay. I put third party debt in there. How do I possibly have a problem? And it's fair to say that there's two bookends in the PCG as to what's okay and what's potentially an issue. So one bookend, and if we use this as an example, is if, say, the related party debt was put in place first and you knew that that was bridging debt only whilst you got your third party debt in place, then I think the ATO rightly says that, well, that should be okay, because the whole point of the related party debt and then the refi was not to get out of the DDCR. You were going to do it all along. I guess, and this is probably one where you mention your thoughts and the feedback, is what is thought not to be okay is if you have this fact pattern that we've got on the screen now, and you go, well, actually, what I'll do instead is refinance the debt by putting third-party debt into Australia and then using that debt to effectively repay the related party debt and the offshore bank, there is a suggestion that that is a problem. And so the original consultation talked about you could have a relationship bank and you're just shuffling the deck chairs. Is this an example of debt dumping? I guess the counter to all that is, as I said originally, well, if I'd simply put third-party debt in Australia in the first place, I wouldn't be having this issue. But again, be interested in your thoughts as to, where is the middle ground? So where we are looking to restructure and use debt and not equity, what's the ATO's thinking?
Yeah, sure, Cameron. I probably can't say too much on the third-party debt scenario that you're putting in front of me, but I can say that to the extent that stakeholders ask for some sort of safe harbour where Part 4A or the DDCR would not apply just because there's third-party debt involved now, we've certainly not taken that approach, and we're not looking to change that approach. There are certainly some risks involved around debt dumping that we would like to address that do involve third-party debt. What we have certainly seen when the submissions are starting to come through is that there are additional factors that are being added either into the example or additional scenarios that are presenting themselves that we might be able to also put out there as low risk to assist taxpayers in restructuring their affairs. And we're certainly open to discussing that.
The Then the final one was just, there's a comment in there about, as I said at the outset, there's a suggestion that you could contrive to get yourself into the third-party debt test to avoid these rules. So if anyone successfully contrived to get round those rules, then I'm all ears.
And why anyone would sanely put themselves into the external third-party debt test is a whole different conversation, right? So, okay, so we might just quickly, just in the interest of time, just move on to a quick recap of the ThinCap and transition into the ThinCap. Again, not intending to reinterrogate that table other than to point out some of the obvious crosses and ticks between the various different tests. Anecdotally, I think we're very much getting the communication from our client base that the FRT is pretty well the only test that's meaningfully applicable. The 15-year carry forward is a significant mitigation. Capital-intensive industries with large depreciation or amortisation deductions, such as yourselves, would definitely the case, or infrastructure or otherwise. So, you know, there's a whole raft of elements there that really do point out, and that table is quite an elegant summary. I can't claim credit for it, and it's yours, Cameron, I think. But it's a very elegant point just to bring out some of the key issues. The key issues section down there below, there's obviously a range of things. Again, we're not here to go over those. Again, the carry forward losses kind of recognition in the FRT is something we'll come to in a moment. The gateways between the various definitions, various thresholds, 10, 20, 50, in terms of recognition and excess capacities and the like, is another massive issue. And there's, again, we'll come back to that in a slide in a moment. And just some of the complexity around the obliger group and how that kind of plays out. So that's just a really useful summary of that. Let's move on to the next slide. This is something that our TP colleagues get very excited about because they figure that finally transfer pricing has taken its justified and warranted view as the be-all and end-all of tax. This is simply around the repeal of the ordering rule that basically said that in applying ThinCap, you basically ignored the transfer pricing rules. Harjeet, would welcome a comment from you as to the feedback from industry, but this is going to significantly impact on the compliance pathway for clients and taxpayers, because they've first got to determine whether or not their debt structure is arm's length per 815, and then move into a ThinCap analysis. So really, everyone knows it. There's not a lot more that I can say to it than that, but would welcome if you're able to share any kind of points of view that were expressed through the various submissions that the ATO's received.
Yeah, sure. I think I've talked about the PCD, obviously, the DDCR PCD has been a priority item. The second item that we've received submissions on and we're working diligently on right now to finalise before the end of this year is a ruling on the third-party debt test. And the third piece of priority public advice and guidance is to look to provide some guidance, whether that's interpretive or non-interpretive, on this particular change to 815-140. Something you said earlier, Matt, around previously not requiring to consider arm's length debt amount. I think 815-140 still required you to price according to your arm's length debt amount. You just didn't apply it or your interest rate to that amount.
Yep.
So I appreciate, though, that that's theoretical and really not that helpful.
Thank
because at the end of the day, this is a real step change, right? And we do acknowledge that. There will likely be some communications coming out about that approach over the next few days, so do look out on our advice under development page. And I think we've also appreciate it doesn't get to the heart of this issue. We do have some web guidance out as well, and to the extent where we come up to issues that we might not consider to be interpretive but might provide some helpful guidance on taxpayers trying to apply the new law, we do try to keep that updated, and we've already done that after releasing it once for the interaction of the DDCR and Division 7A, as well as the interaction around the ordering rules. There were some comments that we did on that.
It was nice the EM referred to as just a consequential amendment when I put this one through, so slightly yes. More than that.
No, it's the elephant sniggering away in the corner, right? So it's
yeah, exactly. And is there any in terms, because this is also not grandfathered, so in terms of the guidance you're going to put out with what people have in place, because otherwise my sense would be that this would just overwhelm the industry if they had to go through the full TP overlay of every single loan that's on there.
Yeah, I can't say we have looked at transitional relief in that particular lens, Cameron. Certainly looked at it in applying the third-party debt test, and we can talk about that in a little bit.
Excellent.
Yeah, the one comment I had from a TP advisor was saying whether or not they can use 30% EBITDA is not a bad proxy for what you could normally get.
Yeah.
Well, no safe harbour.
Yes,
indeed. It is. It's an absolute maximum, not a safe harbour.
So the next one, so which we thought we'd spend some time on as well, because this one is, particularly in the infrastructure industry and others, is causing a fair bit of grief as to people try and navigate the rules. Also, for even though banks aren't subject to these provisions, it is causing issues within the banks as to, more from a lender perspective, as to the type of terms that are going through. So this probably was one of the changes to what was originally announced, where the Labor had said we'll just retain the arm's length debt test, but that is clearly not applied. So this is, you know, an alternative to the 30% EBITDA test that Matt was changing on. And as we'll go through, there's just a number of hurdles that you do have to go through to be able to apply the rules, and it can be quite onerous in part and uncertain. So I think people are eagerly awaiting the ATO guidance on it. But just to briefly recap some of the key considerations. So the first one is that, what is related party debt for these purposes? And as Matt alluded to, one of the challenges with these provisions in terms of the relevant associate, there are different thresholds throughout. And indeed, when you try and apply the third party debt test, it's sometimes not clear which threshold you're applying. But there's a basic line is the related party is a 20% associate entity. Will be a related party debt. There's then also an issue which we'll touch on with where interest rate swaps can be considered to be related to the relevant debt interests. So that's kind of what is, you know, related party debt for these purposes. There's then a conduit concept which we'll touch on in a moment. Won't dwell on this. It's a one-in, all-in consideration. So again, who is a member of your obligor group, and not so relevant for this space, but it's causing grief with staple groups.
Particularly with the loss of the carry forward.
Yeah, exactly. I guess then when we go into where people are looking for guidance, and this is where there's a general theme coming through these rules, that tracing is back with a vengeance, not just for DDCR, because the first one is the use of the funds, and so you have to use all or substantially all of the borrowings to fund commercial activities in Australia, but that knocks out related party debt and equity, which will come on. So clearly tracing is going to be important. There's then terms like what is meant by funding commercial activities in Australia. What does that actually mean in practice? And there are undoubtedly going to be things that the ATO will be providing guidance on in due course.
Yeah, sure. I think it's probably limited in what I can say, given we're so close to the release of that, and it is on track to release by the end of this year. So yeah, do look out for that over the coming weeks. But we have tried to be a bit ambitious in trying to cover all the concepts that you've just mentioned, Cameron. Conduit financer rules, we won't be covering that. We've made that clear in our priority guidance, just to get something out in a timely manner. We're just covering off on the base case third party debt conditions. You know, we'll cover off on what is recourse, what is meant by that, what is an Australian asset, minor and insignificant, substantially all. I think we'll try to provide as many helpful examples as we can. The one thing I did want to mention, though, prior to you reading that ruling, is the EM makes it quite clear the context in which this test is to be read, and that is a narrow test. It's not meant to apply to any third-party debt entering Australia. It is really there for some particular industry groups and their structures, and we're seeking to provide that helpful guidance to ensure that they can apply the rules. But what it will be accompanied with is an additional Schedule 3 and potentially another schedule to the PCG. And that will assist, I think, with entities that may find themselves not passing the third-party debt test because of an interpretation that they may not have been aware of at the time that the rules came in force. And so we are recognising, I think, as part of that, the transition, and want to ensure that taxpayers know where they stand, but can also then restructure their affairs within a timely manner, and apply these provisions.
And it's probably just worth touching on, and we'll go through a couple other examples as to unpacking where some of that uncertainty is. So the final condition of the third party debt test is what your security, you can have security over, and what is, you know, good credit support. So you kind of got to go through a bunch of hurdles, so to speak. So, you know, who am I paying? It is an associate. Where have my funds been used, and what is acceptable security? And that really turns on what are Australian assets, because you can only have security over those. You know, what about intangible assets? And probably the big one really is, well, what is meant by recourse? Are we talking direct, indirect in all cases? Some of the extreme cases, examples where people have concerns is basic stuff such as a letter of credit or either where you have a claim over a third party who's not actually in the group. So I think there will be a lot of welcome guidance on that. Other concepts such as minor or insignificant foreign assets are going to be important as well. The other one, just to, so we don't lose sight of it, is you know, there's what you can have security over, and then there's acceptable credit support. And the basic proposition in this case is that credit support from a foreign parent, and this is where it uses the 50% threshold, not that 20%, is prima facie out and is out in all cases. There are some exceptions where you're receiving credit support from Australian-based groups, where, you know, again, in the infra or development phase, you might be okay. But clearly, that concept of indirect recourse to assets, I think, is one which guidance will be welcome. What it clearly is meaning is that inbounds, where they've got parent guarantee support, will be at a disadvantage potentially compared to their Australian counterparts. So that's what's happening on the third party debt test in particular.
One of the things that's going to be interesting for me, I think, over the next 12 months, 2 years, is distinction, similarities, differences between 815 arm's length debt and the arm's length debt for the third party debt test. There's clearly some fairly significant kind of baseline differences, but it's going to be interesting to see how that journey kind of morphs over the next couple of years, and I think the ATO guidance will be fairly fundamental in that. So, watch this space.
Probably the other aspect, we've put a few examples here, so the other limb to the third party debt test is the conduit exception, and I think you were saying it's not going to be covered in detail, albeit there are a lot of, I guess, issues that people are grappling with. And just to briefly recap what this rule is doing is, again, it's not uncommon, as we went through some examples with the DDCR, is that you have a treasury entity or a finco that does the borrowing, and then that gets on lent within the group. If you didn't have a conduit exemption, then the third party debt test becomes useless, because clearly there is a related party thing going on. So what these rules are trying to do is, in broad terms, is where you effectively on lend on the same terms, then, you know, you should be able to avail yourself of a conduit exemption, which basically means you can apply the third party debt test in this example between project, trust and finco. The other call out, I guess, is just because finco might avail itself of one of the other exemptions, insolvency, remote and the like, but you still need to rely on the conduit exemption to go through. I guess what this example is calling out is probably where it comes up in a number of instances in the ThinCap provisions, is where there was an amendment to the original bill, something came out, and then the EM says you should be okay, but then when you try and work through the provisions, there's a question mark. And what this example is going through is, say, well, the EM says that I can pass on my swap costs, and interest rate swaps only, cross-currency swaps likely a problem. But basically, the EM says the rule should work so I can pass on my interest rate swaps to the ultimate borrower in the group. The problem, though, is when you then, and there's provisions which clearly say you should be able to do that. Potential technical issue is then when you get to the primary provisions to say, well, you can only include a swap payment when it doesn't go to an associate in the third party debt test. The provisions start to break down a bit. I think there should be a way through it from the principle of, well, one reading doesn't give effect to a bunch of provisions and another reading does. But I guess that's a type of example as to where people have been grappling with. This is also an area where you clearly are seeing restructures to make sure you can avail yourself of the conduit financing exemption, and it all comes down to really playing with the on-lending.
I think all I can say really is watch this space in this regard, and certainly heard your example and one that's been raised loudly by industry and one that we will try to address. I appreciate the point that I made earlier that we wouldn't be addressing the conduit financing rules. I think the particular provision that you've got in the question on the slide there, Cameron, is within the Fed pay debt test conditions, and therefore we will try to address it. It might not be from an interpretive perspective. I do have the role in the ATO with providing public advice and guidance in this particular new measure, and it's not exactly something that everyone wants to jump in and take, because there is some tough provisions to get through. So we might need to look at using some of our compliance guidance to provide some relief.
Yeah, I think that's a good call out, because even with the DDCR, there are some difficult technical issues there, and the PCG, I think, is at least giving us a way forward.
Yep.
Probably just rounding out some of the discussion point, and Matt, did you want to touch on this one?
Oh, look, again, the FRT, I think it's, it is the default test. I don't think there's any doubt there. Again, not going to re-interrogate. I think it's interesting having conversations with our colleagues overseas. You start rolling out a 30% tax EBITDA test, and our North American colleagues and our European colleagues sort of nod their head because it's something they're familiar with. Classic treasury swings and roundabouts, capital intensive, heavy balance sheet industries versus earning industries and the like. So again, there's comments in there that I think there's some slides we're going to talk about in and around the tax loss recognition, so Division 36, and how that's recognised in your FRT EBITDA calc. Again, some significant holes in there or gaps. Okay, thank you. I'm sure it's a complete coincidence that happened when I was talking. About sort of 10% associate entities being excluded, but then the excess EBITDA from other entities being included. And I think one of the really welcome provisions that were introduced as part of the supplementary EM was that excess amount coming back. In a perfect world, it would have matched the 10 or 20% for the balance of it, but 50% is better than nothing. So, so with that, I think back to you, Cameron. I think we're just going
to... Yeah, and one of the things we just wanted to deal with, and this is probably... and I raise this because the last time I did this presentation, someone asked and said, within firms there's different views on how the losses get dealt with. So I guess one of the adjustments you have to make when you're figuring out your EBITDA is there's a rule that says, you must assume that the entity chooses to deduct all of the entity's tax losses for that loss year. And so... a couple of questions which keep coming up is, first one, which I think is probably the easy one, is saying, well, what if I've got available fraction losses? Do I assume, it's 100%, or do I apply the available fraction? I think the way it's drafted, you would say, well, no, you assume the available fraction applied, and then you figure out what losses was available, is my own 2 cents. What this example is trying to draw out, though, is saying, well, when I'm doing my step one, before I do my various add backs, do I take into account all of my losses, which potentially puts me into a negative position before I do my add backs, or do I only reduce down to whatever taxable income I had for that year? And that is going to throw up a difference, because the obvious point, the less tax EBITDA I have for that income year, the less interest I can deduct, which means the more carry forward I have, which is subject to the 15-year and SBT and COTS. So, as I say, we've put up two examples there, one where you go into negative and the other one you don't. There's no guidance in the EM or otherwise, and it just becomes down to a debate, what does choosing to deduct all of your losses mean for these purposes with a calculation? It's one of those ones, as I say, I'm aware of multiple views out there, so it's a worthwhile example putting up to debate, and undoubtedly maybe one where the ATO puts out some guidance in due course.
Yeah, sure.
Can I do something a little different? Can I do a vox pop of the room? If you're happy to. If you believe that the top example is the right answer, where you actually deduct all of your available tax losses, put up your hand. Okay, yep, thank you. All right, I'll take it by a show of no hands that the majority of the
There's one hand here at the front. We'll take that.
Okay, you'll take two? You happy with that? Okay. Well, for what it's worth, my personal view is the bottom one's right. So, but yeah, it's an interesting one. We grapple with this a fair bit. So.
Yeah, so it's just one of the examples that the tax EBITDA and the 30% is normally relatively straightforward, you'd think, but there are some nuances in the calculation.
Yep.
The final one, and there's different names for this, is I like to call it the Valley of Death, is the that whole, there was that welcome change where, and this is really where, you know, if you're in a console group, this is not a problem for you. It's where you have, it's this common infrastructure space, you know, trusts and non-consolidated structures. And really, the issue was that there's two rules at play. On the one hand, when you're doing your EBITDA calculation, you exclude distributions from your 10% plus associate entities. So in this example, entity 2 and 3 are disregarded. You then only get to add back your excess tax EBITDA, but in that case, you have to have a 50% plus stake.
Hmm.
And so what it means is, as is not uncommon, where you've got a third, a third, a third, as you will have issues. So in this case, entity 2 sits in that valley of death of between 10 and 49.99%. Why does all this matter? Because it's pretty common to have the interest deductions upstream, but the operations downstream. And if suddenly all your EBITDA gets knocked out, you don't have enough EBITDA at the top level and no interest deductions for you. So again, I think this is one where we put up, this is probably one where it's not possible for the ATO to interpret around it or to provide administrative guidance because the rules are quite clear. And despite all the submissions that were put up, Treasury in their infinite wisdom decided that this was a good idea.
Yeah, look, we're seeing a lot of movement in the joint venture space in and around this as well, not surprisingly, because it can be immensely challenging. So
they're the key ones. The only one I had, and again, if someone has a view on this, happy to chat after or drinks, is how one applies the group ratio test, where you have different income years between your offshore group and your Australian group. I still can't figure that one out.
Right. Well, we somehow, by a small miracle, probably because I didn't say much, we're actually running on time, if not ahead of time. So happy to take any questions from the floor or challenges or points of view or we've got a good sort of 10, 12 minutes left. So,
Matt, while people are thinking, I thought that poll was a bit unfair. I was just reflecting on it that two people put their hands up, but it might be that the rest of the room might not have even considered the issue. Is there any chance we could take that poll? To see if we go back to that slide,
do I need to ask for a third category? So who thinks one, who thinks two, and who doesn't know?
Yeah,
is that probably okay? All right, well, why not? Let's go. So we're at an 01. So those brave souls who are clearly the only ones in the room under tax office audit at the moment.
I can't read your name tags from here.
So group two, who believes that the 100 versus 100 is the right approach? Okay. And group three, who doesn't understand the issue, doesn't know, or is
needs to consider
to
it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. Interesting.
And I don't ask that out of jest.
Absolutely.
To work out if this is an issue that we do need to. Put on the.
I think it is, and again, if you go back to your 40,000 foot kind of concept, at least in my mind, and I'm a very simple person. The whole idea of losses and the whole theme of Division 36 and one of the welcome changes to the loss rules was that ability for taxpayers to self-assess how much losses they wanted to utilise.
Mm.
Excess franking credits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So for me, at least philosophically, the ability to actually choose how much of your losses you utilise in that calc is consistent with our kind of ethos. So
yeah.
I think when I look at it from a more purpose and intent, then I think the second one actually just intuitively makes more sense.
Correct.
That's my personal view.
I think probably balance, I'm not making a call here, is live discussion, but if you look at the purpose of tax EBITDA.
Yeah.
And what the FRT is designed to do.
Yep.
There doesn't seem to be anything throughout that test that seems to say or suggest that partway through that calculation there can't be a negative amount.
Yeah.
Except for right at the end. So yeah, look, it's one I think is worth us considering.
Yeah, and look, I don't think there's any question that the impact of this is mitigated by the fact you either have a subject to BCT, COT, SBT, et cetera, you've got an uncarried, unlimited carry forward tax loss, or you've got a 15-year.
Hmm.
And I think credit to government, credit to the tax office, I think the ability to carry forward the 15 years under the FRT is long by global standards, I think would be fair to say. And I think it's been an incredibly mitigating factor. And I think a lot of clients, in a very practical sense, have gone, okay, we lose it now, but at least we get to carry it forward. So I think government and or Treasury and or tax office to be credited for that. So Al, you've got some questions you wanted to...
But you got zero coming through on the iPad yet, so I'm not sure if that's working or we just don't have any questions. But still no more from the floor before we carry on. So I think we had one question which is probably a little broader, understanding that the proposed repeal of 2590 was considered as part of the review of interest deductibility. Obviously that has been deferred, and Harjit, I won't put you on the spot here, but if the panel has a kind of crystal ball view as to the potential future of 2590.
Well, deferred or replaced? I think we had both terms used at the same time, didn't we? So
oh yeah, one would hope that the DDSS enough, so leave us alone.
Well, I think the only people who went out of 2590 being repealed are probably two of the three of us, or three of the four of us sitting up on the bench. So it's a difficult one. In my view, I think DDCR appears to be a much more targeted measure. It does come with wrinkles, but I think the 2590 repeal, I would hope, is off the table. So on the basis that, you know, sledgehammer walnut kind of point of view. So yeah, I hope that it is replaced by DDCR rather than being deferred.
Probably the last chance for any questions from the floor. All right, well then, on behalf of everyone, I'd like to thank Cameron, Matthew and Harjit for their time and very informative session. Thank you.